It's the Pop Medic Podcast for April 8th, 2015. The war is over. Podcast where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and hanging out with me today are
Amanda,
Mark,
Stonewall Jeremy.
Just the four of us today. This week is the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War. What's the 150th anniversary called?
Sesquicentennial.
That's a big word.
Sesquicentennial.
So what's that?
S-E-S.
So what's that to do with Sasquatches Go?
Can I call it centennial and a half?
Sure.
Is that okay?
Centennial 0.5.
Okay. So because of the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, you know, the last few years they've been all kinds of programs, especially at museums and libraries. But, you know, there's never been a Pop-matic podcast.
Until now.
That's right. We swooped in at the last second.
Yeah. Hey, 150 years later?
Yeah. They're waiting to hear our version of it.
That's
I've
right.
been waiting for this day.
This is going to change the way people interpret history.
This is like finding a new photograph of Lincoln.
I gotta tell you guys, this was a really hard one for me. I mentioned the extent of my love of Civil War history in last week's episode. Some of the things that I considered were season two of Twin Peaks, Ben Hort, played by Richard Boehmer, has a psychotic break and he believes he's a Confederate general.
Yes.
But I already talked about Twin Peaks a lot, so I didn't want to go with that. I could talk about a field in England, which is set during the English Civil War.
Boom.
Ooh.
And more about, you know, psychedelic mushrooms and alchemy than really about even the English Civil War. We've talked about that before. And then I was like, oh, the Matmos album, The Civil War, is where they sample, like, Civil War period instruments and then, like, you know, chop that all up and create new songs. But the library doesn't have that record. But I found... Yeah, I know, exactly. But I found out that the library does have Matmos' Rat Relocation Program album, which is an album they just made from sounds of rats in cages, literally. And that's kind of out of print. That's kind of rare. But you know,
sounds like a Brian pick. Yeah.
But
check. Awesome.
That's what I. What did you talk about on the Civil War episode? Well, Matmos made this album about rats in cages. It was a perfect fit. But you know, it's kind of weird that Matador Records aren't anywhere in the library's digital services. So we should work on that.
Really?
But yeah, exactly. Huh. So, but then I was like, well, I could talk about the Basque History of the World by Mark Kurlansky because there's a lot of stuff about the Spanish Civil War in there. And then I was like, well, I talked about that before too. Then I was like, this doesn't have anything to do with the Civil War. I'll talk about Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals. That's all about the Civil War, right?
Haven't we talked about
it's
that?
It's also like 3,000 pages long.
Yeah, okay. She's a public historian. It's easy to read. It reads like a novel, but it is really, really long. I'm like, well, let's go shorter. How about Milliken's Bend, a Civil War battle in history and memory by the library's own Linda Barnacle?
Oh.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Right, perfect, right? Kind of academic. I don't know if it's for everybody. I haven't read it either. But then I was like, so...
Wait, is that the one? Didn't she win an award for that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That's the one she won the award for.
She took a sabbatical?
Yeah.
This book was praised everywhere.
Yeah.
But then I was like, well, we got to do a novel, right? Because this is like the Pop-matic podcast, and I'm like the fiction guy. How about Devil's Dream by Madison Smart Bell? He has a Nashville connection. It's about controversial subject matter. It's about... you know, the Confederate general.
Nathan Bedford Forrest.
Exactly. And I was like, yeah, oh, that's perfect. Yeah, but I didn't read that.
And he has that beautiful statue here in Nashville.
I drive by it every day.
Yeah, he does?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. 65 South. South. All those flags are, that's Nathan Bedford Forrest.
Yeah. Okay, wow, I missed that. Okay.
Yeah. Well, go take a look at it.
Golly.
And I've never read that book, so I'm not going to talk about anything. I'm just going to pass it to Mike.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you did like slightly recommend an entire library's worth of stuff, but okay.
Just a question. Do we have a copy of Linda's that's checkoutable, or is there just one in the Nashville room?
Yes, there is a checkoutable version of Milliken's Bend, okay. A Civil War Battle in History and Memory.
Do we know where Milliken's Bend it was?
Oh, Linda,
I like to ask hard questions.
It's bendy, and Milliken was there.
And there's probably a river. Water.
So it is a a place in Mississippi,
okay.
And now it's in the middle of nowhere. And there is, like, one historical marker, like, out on, like, some country road that you would never go on, and a Yankee like me would be scared, right, to be on that road.
To have a travel buddy.
Yeah. And
still you're a long way from the city,
yes.
Boy.
Yeah. And, but that marker is actually, like, a few miles from where the battle actually took place. And it was a Union force composed predominantly of former slaves Confederate soldiers. And it was, like, really violent and brutal.
One more question. Yeah. Do you know what year it was in?
I don't know when it happened. Editor's note. The Battle of Milliken's Bend took place on June 7th, 1863. But Linda gave an awesome presentation during the Southern Festival of Books, and that's on C-SPAN, and you can watch. And you can also hear some ugly, stupid librarian that doesn't know anything about the Civil War asking her questions. If
could that be the rare appearance of Johnny Nobrain?
Johnny Nobrain.
You're gonna write a song?
Johnny Nobrain.
Johnny Nobrain.
Well, I thought it was going to be like some sort of like gay zombie erotica panel or something. It was a Civil War book.
They had
a
book. To that.
It was like fine line.
Yeah.
And
I want to see a different.
What does Milligan refers to?
What did I say at the beginning?
Anyway,
so
take you anywhere.
So, bring it down.
I bring it down.
Every time.
So
a lot in life.
And I will say this. Anyone that knows Linda, I mean, she's sort of like your typical introverted archivist historian, if you know her. I went to this panel, and she totally, like, turned on and was in, like, full, like, outgoing professor mode. It was awesome. It was good. Like,
that's
it
cool.
was, like,
so she geeked out like we do every week.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, you're asking me about Spider-Man?
Well, well, Miles Morales was.
You might want to sit down, because I have notes.
Yeah. Well, there's multiple timelines to see.
Okay, now, Ben Reilly is a whole different story.
Okay, Mike, I'm sorry.
That's okay. You know, I just...
I will link to Linda's book talk, and those actual questions can be answered.
We can do our
own
research.
And that's also why I didn't actually talk about the book. I just mentioned it. Okay.
Well, you know, so as a Southern gentleman, I thought I would first say that, you know, growing around the Atlanta area, it's like everything was either Coca-Cola or Gone with the Wind.
Which I just would like to insert in my favorite book all time ever.
Oh. Well, I didn't read the book, so the book may be good.
If I could only have one book on a desert island, that would be it. Wow.
The book may be good, but the movie is...
Movie is still good. Don't mean to bring you down.
Don't bring me down!
Oh!
I'm playing it.
I just, you know, 4 hours of, you know, will she go out with this guy to manipulate him into giving all him all of his money? You know, I don't know.
You know, it's based on Margaret Mitchell's real life, though.
Yeah, well, you know.
I mean, like, she had two guys that were like that.
I guess, you know. Did one guy have giant ears and the other guy was blonde and died early?
Spoilers!
Oh, Ashley was the best.
I knew lots of dudes named Ashley in high school.
Ooh, did one have like a severed arm and like could like have a chainsaw on the end?
No. Would that have made
the movie better?
Yes. 1,000%. You know, I'll never go hungry again.
Here's a cut of meat.
I'll swallow your soul, stop it is.
Anyway, I'm sorry.
Just to be devil's advocate, I would totally take the side of Gone with the Wind in this Gone with the Wind, Evil Dead battle that's happening now, but like I don't know a lot about the Civil War.
I would choose Coca-Cola over Gone with the Wind personally.
Yes, Coca-Cola is Coke is it, as they say. Anywho, so today I thought I'd recommend yet another boring history book. Unfortunately, I pulled a Brian. I haven't actually finished it yet, but I don't think, there's no spoiler alert. I'm not sure who's going to win.
Hey, the South may rise again. You never know.
You never know. You know, I've only got about 70 pages left. The book is called The Cause of All Nations, An International History of the Civil War by Don H. Doyle. Oh boy, one of those rare books we get downstairs that I immediately put a hold on, and I was excited to get it. Huzzah, huzzah, because I knew that the Civil War wasn't just a local war, but it also had global ramifications. In fact, it is not as emphasized in as many history books. I thought I'd just, like, whip out some cool facts that I've gleaned from reading it this week. Like, I did not know that the Union Army asked Giuseppe Garibaldi, the hero of unification, the hero of two worlds, as he was called, the rank of major general in the Union Army. This is a big deal at the time, because there were a few people in the world who were more respected militarily, and it was seen as a way of both impressing the foreign powers and intimidating the South into, like, you know, oh no, we can't beat it because it's led by Garibaldi.
I don't think that worked. I think they tried anyway.
Well, it didn't work.
Where's Garibaldi from?
He was Italian.
Italian.
He, you know, he initially went to South America and helped people, like, overthrow their, you know, liberty and stuff in South America. And then he went to Italy and helped, like, you know, unify Italy, which at that time was, you know, still broken up from
city,
like,
states.
Yeah, from the Renaissance times. And he also, like, made it to where, like, the Pope didn't have temporal power anymore. It was all, like, you know, religious.
So no more time traveling for the Pope?
You gotta cut back. It's so costly.
Yeah, it's true. Pope was
those robes. Whoa. Take so much wear and tear.
Oh, it's been one Pope the entire time. He's a time lord who regenerates.
Oh my god, it's beautiful.
Every 16 years. Why have enough? Why has this not been written?
No copyright.
Anywho, Garibaldi actually accepted, but the conditions he had were that he be made commander-in-chief, which is against the Constitution. And the war being defined as being about abolition, which in that time, in 1861, both the North and the South were, like, petitioning the foreign powers as it be the war being more about, like, a legal thing. You know, like, the South couldn't leave because it goes against the Constitution and that kind of thing. And that, you know, it wasn't until after the Emancipation Proclamation, that sort of thing, that, like, you know, oh yeah, this is about slavery. They, you know, both sides would actually admit it. So, but the European powers found that kind of boring. It's like, oh, you legal stuff? Who cares, you know?
We're bored. Let's eat cake.
Yeah. Delicious cake. Ooh. But according to Wikipedia, after Lincoln released the Emancipation Proclamation, Garibaldi would say that about Lincoln that posterity will call you the great emancipator, a more enviable title than any crown could be, and greater than any merely mundane treasure. European conservatives welcomed the Union defeat. A weakened United States would be unable to enforce the Monroe Doctrine, and with the Confederacy as a buffer, the Catholic powers in Europe, like France, Spain, and Austria, could reconquer vast swaths of South America in the name of Catholic unity. During the war, you know, while the North and the South were distracted, Napoleon III installed a puppet regime in Mexico, the Empire of Mexico, under Maximilian I. And, fun fact, when the... you guys having fun?
It's great.
I'm loving it. I don't know. It's
just... You guys taking a nap?
I really like...
We lost Jeremy.
You guys were talking about how long I talk.
this is the most I've ever written, ever.
That's true.
Remember, like, 2 weeks ago?
It's a big book.
When it was, like, a line? It's so great.
Yeah, 7.19.
I'm pulling, like, the Jeremy-style rant from us. And I'm only halfway through. This book is really good, guys.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Who wins the war?
Well, gang.
The French come in and save the day.
But then at one point, the Mexicans repelled the French army, and that's how we got Cinco de Mayo.
Yay.
Woo. It's bueno, no?
Hell yeah.
Yeah, so the American Civil War is indirectly responsible with Cinco de Mayo.
You're welcome.
Yeah, so in an alternate universe.
I call it Drinco de Mayo.
Yeah, you know, drunkards in the United States will have to find a different holiday from overseas to get drunk. Let's see here. Karl Marx was working as a reporter for the New York Herald Tribune based in London at the time, and he was pro-union. Go figure.
That proves the South's right.
Oh, and unfortunately, I left off when the European powers would quit flip-flopping and fully endorse the Union instead of the Confederacy. Oh, damn it. I assumed it had to do with Antietam. The story that I heard is that if the League had won a decisive victory, both Britain and France would recognize the Confederacy and try to end the war diplomatically or go to war with the United States.
The Confederates were waiting for France to come and save the day, and they never did.
Actually, yes.
That's why so many conservative Southerners are like, French, surrender monkeys.
That's right.
I eat freedom fries.
That's right. Freedom fries, freedom toast.
It goes all the way back to them.
Yeah. They're still sore.
Yeah. But apparently, the next part of the book says that Garibaldi marched on Rome, which also changed their minds. I'm excited. But I guess I'll find that out later and say a future correction. Oh boy. What have you got, Amanda?
Okay. As I mentioned earlier, I have been a Gone with the Wind fan since fourth grade when I read it for the first time. And so... Punch Mike.
Ow!
that I don't mean to bring you down, Kyle?
Think they're just throwing, they're trying to slice each other with their don't bring me down cards.
I just say I'm on the winning side, but that's
no.
So I kind of went through a Civil War phase where I've read a ton of Civil War fiction, and it had actually been a little bit since I had read any, so when I picked up the book I'm going to talk about today, it was kind of, I felt like I was coming home. Like I was like, oh, yeah, I know why I read stuff like this.
Soldier.
So I'm actually going to talk about women who served as soldiers during the Civil War. There were approximately, I've heard 200, I've heard 400, I've heard 600 documented cases. They usually settle on 400 of women who actually served as soldiers during the Civil War. And this is according to the Sanitary Commission, which was what kind of monitored nursing and all of that. The problem people, that women that served were quick to be stigmatized, either as mentally unbalanced, because why would a woman ever want to do that, or they were prostitutes. However, women did, they served as soldiers, they were spies, they were nurses, and many of them, kind of like in World War II, took over men's jobs at home. They'd have to run the farm and take care of all the animals while their men were off at war. Two famous nurses were Louisa May Alcott, who wrote Little Woman, and I think her dad actually served in the Union Army, and Clara Barton, who later founded the American Red Cross. She served as a nurse at both of the Battle of Bull Runs, or Manassas, if you're... The Southern bent. And she actually helped soldiers on both. Like, she didn't care Union, Confederate. She just helped you if you were in pain. However, there were women who wanted to serve in the front lines, either to accompany family members, husbands, instead of having to stay home and worry, or they were just sisters who wanted to go with their brothers. Some of the women actually became pregnant while they were in the ranks. And one woman fought at the Battle of Stones River when she was 5 months pregnant without anybody knowing that she was a woman. So kudos to her for keeping that hidden. And another soldier was not actually discovered until she gave birth to her baby in 1864. So I'm like, I don't know how you think you're going to hide that.
I'm not fat.
Like, shut up, it's just a bad shirt.
I've been eating too many of these handy biscuits.
I'm liking these. Hot tack.
Hot tack, thank you.
So there was one soldier, Sarah Rosetta Wakeman, and she served with the 153rd Regiment from New York State, and she was one who actually wrote home about her gender and the struggles that she faced. She just went because she was independent and just wanted to serve her country, and she saw the war more as a source of freedom, and I guess it was apparently she had a really strict home life. So the book I'm going to talk about is called I Shall Be Near to You. It was written by Erin Lindsay McCabe. It came out last year, and I had put it on hold. I just hadn't gotten to it yet, but I'm glad I read it. So basically, McCabe bases her book on Sarah Rosetta Wakeman. Her character is called, her name is Rosetta, and then she marries a gentleman called Jeremy Wakeman, so she becomes Rosetta Wakeman. And her story is based kind of on the letters that Sarah had written. In the war, she changes her name to Ross Stone because her husband always teased her about being his stone lady, so that she became his cousin and fought alongside him. The story takes place during 1862, and they fight in the Second Battle of Bull Run, and then, you know, they have some skirmishes, and then the book ends more or less just after the Battle of Antietam, or the Battle of Sharpsburg.
Get it right.
For those of you who don't know what we're doing, like, the Union refers to some battles as some things, and the South refers to the battles as other things. So, like, Antietam is the Union way of viewing it. Sharpsburg is the Southern way of delineating
it. Antietam's such a cooler word.
I know, right?
It sounds so much
and
cooler.
If you don't know, Antietam was the single bloodiest battle in American history, with almost 23,000 casualties in one day.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, we haven't ever come any. So, it obviously, you know, it was fairly tragic. As I'm reading this book, and I'm going to give spoilers about what happens, but...
Will they be near to you?
I'd never do that. Like, I would never go to war with my husband. Like, I couldn't. Like, it was just horrible. I mean, I couldn't. I don't know that I'm not strong enough. I just would not be what I would want to do. So I was just amazed at that the woman would actually do this. It was a very good book. Kind of a different perspective on Civil War. And very worthwhile.
Awesome. Now for something completely different.
So, I'm dying to hear what Jeremy's recommending today.
Today I'm going to talk about two songs, which are not really about the Civil War or its ending.
Uh-huh.
But I think...
So they're like people named Lee or Grant or Sherman?
Yeah, it says that sound appears in both the songs. No, that's not true. They are related in a
civilly song or
tertiary way. That's not even right. Peripherally related. I'm always on the peripherals here. I'm all about the peripherals. So if you want all the drama and bloat
in a faux seriousness of a middle-of-the-road Hollywood Civil War film in one song, all you need to do is crank up Guns N' Roses Civil War. This song is from their 1991 Use Your Illusion 2 album, and it doesn't explicitly mention the U.S. Civil War, which is what we're talking about. I don't know if you were going to correct and later next week and say we were talking about the U.S. Civil War. I feel like someone
I got the impression we could have done any Civil War if we wanted to.
Yeah, no, but I'm just... Anyway, you know, some people don't have a United States-centric view of the world. And
that's right.
For all our international listeners.
Willkommen. Bienvenidos.
That didn't know whenever we did a Civil War scene.
Civil War.
Exactly. That didn't know that when we did a Civil War themed episode... It was about the American Civil War, or the United States Civil War. I apologize.
Man, I thought we were going to talk about Oliver Cromwell, Roundheads, and Cavaliers.
No need to apologize. No. So anyway, the song doesn't explicitly mention the U.S. Civil War, but it begins with Axl Rose whistling Johnny Comes Marching Home, so that it counts.
Sure.
Yeah. This is a very long song. It's nearly 8 minutes long, and especially given that it's just like a straight rock song, it's a long song. It's not a prog epic like Yes's Relayer album. I'm gonna play my gratitude card.
Yeah, that was,
to Brian,
that was fun.
For turning me onto that album.
Yeah.
And it's also
get that myself.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Or Emerson, Lake, and Palmer's Tarkus Suite. There's no different movements telling the story and different instrumentation creating the imagery of battles and dying soldiers. If anything, this song sort of evokes fist-bumping blonde dudes slinging beers while their girlfriends raise their tops in the name of rock. It's like a malfunctioning Bic lighter in the pantheon of protest songs. It is a protest song as jock jam. But still, it is very powerful because it features all of the Axl voices. The screech! let's see, what is it? The ballad here, the nasal. And then when he talks really seriously like this, it has this quotation from a Peruvian Shining Path gorilla. We practice selective annihilation of mayors and government officials, for example, to create a vacuum. Then we fill that vacuum. As popular war advances, peace is closer. And it opens with a clip of Strother Martin's failure to communicate speech from Cool Hand Luke. I think the only part of the song that really is easy to take seriously, maybe, is the chorus, because it's just plain spoken truth to power moment. And it's, like I said, it's from Use Your Illusion 2, which maybe I've listened to one time. I think the library has a copy of it that is circulating, but I got this off of Hoopla.
I'll probably have it downloaded.
Yeah, and it's hitting the skip button most of the time through it. But in contrast to this, Bombast is the Elvis Costello and T-Bone Burnett ballad, The Scarlet Tide.
Will I recall his parting words? Must I accept his fate or take myself far from this place? I thought I heard a black bell toll. A little bird did sing. Man has no choice when he wants everything.
This song first appeared on the soundtrack to the film Cold Mountain, which is about the Civil War, and was recorded by Alison Krauss. Now, her version is adorned with strings and piano and sounds very much like a song which would be played over the credits of an Oscar-nominated film. But Elvis's version is from his 2004 album The Delivery Man, and it's just ukulele, his voice, and backup vocals by America's Harmony Laureate, Emmylou Harris. That is a title I just created for Emmylou Harris. And despite the ukulele in this song, it sounds like it could have been played around a campfire, at a funeral, or on the front porch of some mountain home waiting for a loved one who will never return. And unlike Axl, Elvis and T-Bone avoid the grandiose in both the instrumentation and in their lyrical content by eliminating the broad strokes of man's inhumanity toward man, and they create an intimate picture of loss, sorrow, and perseverance. Now, this song was nominated for an Oscar in 2004, but lost to the Annie Lennox song from The Return of the King. Sometimes I'm still mad about this, but my ire will rise again!
Say, for instance, in your version of the Civil War.
I don't need your civil war. It feeds the rich while it buries the power. Your power-hungry selling soldiers in a human grocery store. Ain't that fresh? I don't need your civil war.
This week is Tabletop Day. Tabletop Day is a celebration of board games, which I don't know if you guys know, are currently going through a big resurgence, and I guess I'm trendy and popular because
Brian.
Because I've been obsessed
with
games, and it actually my obsession with games, my re-obsession with games or relapse into gaming obsession is all because of Greg when he started his superheroes program here in the children's department. It was just this one-off program that he did, and it got me researching games again so I could push the idea of turning his program into a role-playing game for kids. But Tabletop Day is April 11th. The whole idea is you get together, you play board games, you can use hashtag tabletop. It's great. It's organized by Geek & Sundry, the folks who produced the Tabletop board game show with Will Wheaton. I'm here in Nashville. There'll be Tabletop Day events at Roll the Dice, which is a really big, nice game store in Murfreesboro. At Hastings, the big everything media store in Murfreesboro, they'll also be playing games all day. Not listed on the Tabletop Day website, but the Games Keep in Hermitage, it's Tabletop Day every day. There's like organized gaming and game groups meet there almost every day of the week.
The folks who run Hypercon will be hosting an all-day gaming event at the Nashville Airport Holiday Inn Express. It's called Boards and Swords. Get it? That's $20 at the door. That will help fundraise for Hypercon, and it's all day.
And then, of course, individual game groups. You should totally check it out. Play a game. Maybe since I was I backed the new season of Tabletop on Kickstarter, I am biased.
Okay, so I have found the new world's best television show.
I completely
agree. Not on television.
100%. Pinot Noir.
So it is called The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. It is created by Tina Fey and Robert Carlock, and I have to say that this is what I wanted 30 Rock to be.
Dope.
Like, I never liked 30 Rock. I thought it was boring.
Oh, bring it down, card.
Bring me down. I know.
That's possibly my favorite sitcom ever.
Oh, I'm sorry, wow. But this one
is
better.
To agree to disagree, wow.
It's disagree day on this side of the
disagree.
Table.
Yeah,
seriously.
Wow. Yeah, usually we get along.
How
appropriate. Civil War at the desk.
There we go.
Oh, well, North and
we
South.
We planned that. So this is a 13-episode first season, and it's on Netflix. It was supposed to be on NBC for the spring of 2015, but they sold it to Netflix, and Netflix said, cool, we'll take two seasons. So you can watch season one now. The basic premise is it stars 29-year-old Kimmy Schmidt, who was kidnapped into an Indiana doomsday cult.
Merry Christmas, sisters.
Apocalypse, apocalypse, we caused it with our dumbness.
A miracle today in Durnsville, Indiana. Four women rescued from an underground apocalypse cult.
It's all still here.
I'm
not going back.
What?
I'm staying here.
Who is this?
I'm your new roommate. I will be very comfortable in here.
You got a secret.
I am one of the Indiana Mole women.
From the news.
I spent 15 years in that bunker eating beans out of a Florida Marlins cap. I just want to be a normal person. I'm having candy for dinner. Scram, you stupid ho- Ooh! Got a job.
Rushing it.
You'll need to be here by 6 every morning to get Buckley up for school. Then get me up at 10, but don't wake me up.
Do you want a water?
No, thanks. Yeah, I'm becoming a shit like a raging
bull. You better be gunning like a cannonball. I don't want to hear you say a thing at all. Please tell me that you're normal.
Oh, I'm very normal. I've had everything normal happen to me.
You yell in your sleep. You bite my nails. And we still don't know why you're afraid of Velcro.
What's your plan? You have maybe 4 years of that youthful glow left. After that, you'll be stuck marrying a primary care physician or one of those off-brand Kennedys.
Life beats you up. You can either curl up in a ball and die, or you can stand up and say, we're different, and you can't break us. You got my
attention. Hey, Red, you're making me wish I was those jeans.
Well, I wish I was your yellow hat. If you want to try me on. Look out, New York! Nothing can stop us now! Don't you keep
me waiting! And I think I have it appeals to me because I'm from Indiana.
Oh,
so I totally get that.
Okay. So how do they do Indiana?
What?
Like the jokes and the, you know...
They're a little bit general.
Okay.
They can, yeah, they can...
Yeah, their jokes about Stone Mountain, Georgia, which I used to live next to, and 30 Rock, were completely wrong. It was kind of fun.
So the pilot began, like the show begins with her rescue there. She got kidnapped because she took the road less traveled. There were 4 girls. One girl got kidnapped because the reverend offered to show her rabbits in the car and she didn't want to be rude. So, which we're very polite in Indiana. One girl just went with him because she thought the reverend had some really good ideas. And he is preaching this doomsday apocalypse cult, so he's completely insane. And then the 4th lady is just a Spanish Mexican lady who was going showing up for Happy Maids, and she thought she was going to clean the place, and they kidnapped her and wouldn't let her leave.
And they never learned Spanish, and she never learned English.
Exactly.
So she like yelled at them in Spanish, and so they're like, whatever.
And then they were like, oh, that's great. Cute. The episode I watched last night actually featured, well, the show stars Ellie Kemper, who is perfect as Kimmy Schmidt. She moves to New York, wants to start life, ends up moving into Carol Kane's basement. And I love Carol Kane. She is just completely brilliant. Her roommate is Titus Andromedon. And he's, you know, the token gay aspiring Broadway performer. And he does have a really beautiful voice and he sings all the time. And then Jane Krakowski plays this, you know, wealthy Manhattanite who Kimmy goes to work with as their nanny. So, I mean, you have all the stereotypes there, but they do work really well. Last night I was watching an episode where Kimmy goes to the plastic surgeon with her boss. And it's played by Martin Short.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah. It took me a minute
it's
to figure
creepy.
It out. Because,
like,
he's under, like, tons of makeup.
He's had some Botox and some hair straightening.
Ooh, it's freaky.
But it is hilarious. And the jokes just fly so fast. Like, I could watch the show 85 times because the jokes just fly really fast. Nice. And Brian always mentions Rotten Tomatoes. The first season currently has a rating of 96% on Rotten Tomatoes. So, and one of the critics said it's as odd as it is hilarious. So, which I would completely agree with. So, if you need a new show and you have Netflix... Or you don't have Netflix, you should get Netflix. And then you need to watch The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt because it is 20 minutes of just awesomeness.
I should say that if it comes to DVD, we'll be picking it up. And we've got Orange is the New Black on DVD. And we also have House of Cards, I believe.
Netflix releases their shows on DVD and the library buys them. So you will be able to get it from the library eventually.
Also, my favorite episode is where Hank from Breaking Bad teaches Titus how to be a man.
I haven't seen that one yet.
It is
on
great.
It too.
It is.
It's got a great cast.
That's cool. Kind of amazing.
it must be fun to be Tina Fey and just call people and be like,
you're
going to be in my show, right? Like, yes.
Well, yeah.
Yes, ma'am. Tits. I will be on your show.
Today, I'm good.
Toads and goats.
Tell Lauren I said hi.
So I watched a documentary this weekend called Finding Fela. About Fela Kuti. I've had a thing for documentaries about artists and musicians lately. I don't really know why, although I'm not really here to endorse it that much because it's okay, you know. I was kind of bummed that it's a lot of it's about like the stupid musical that they put on Broadway, you know. But I've come here to endorse the band that performed the music and the musical. Antibalas, which means bulletproof in Spanish. In the film, Questlove says of Antibalas that they're the most dangerous band in America. I was like, ooh, what's...
That used to be David Letterman's band, Late Night.
Like, what's it, Paul Schaefer would, like, throw things at them?
No, they were called Paul Schaefer and the world's most dangerous band.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
But then they became CBS Orchestra.
You know what's really depressing?
Paul Schaefer
is depressed, is really dangerous.
Paul Schaefer co-wrote It's Raining Men. He is dangerous.
Hallelujah. Best thing ever done was play Hermes and the Disney's Hercules, but
he was in Spinal Tap.
No, well, maybe that's best thing.
Make it so much better.
Antibalas is a modern Afrobeat band based out of Brooklyn. Once I heard they were from Brooklyn, it just made sense. You know, it's a waxed mustache, you know, artisanal coffee. They have what I like about Afrobeat, or at least what little I've heard from it this past weekend. You know, a combination of like funk and soul and jazz with like African rhythms and like language and stuff. Apparently, a lot of it's political. But I don't speak Yoruba or Spanish, so you know, I haven't really noticed. So far, my favorite song of theirs is a remake of a song called Che Che Cole Mocasa, which we have on Freegal. I like that it sounds like a combination of both Afrobeat and cumbia, which is a really cool genre of music from South America, the Caribbean. We also have some of their CDs, which I put holds on. Also, a varied lead. They also collaborated on Bruno Mars' Uptown Funk, a song I don't think I've ever heard in its entirety.
So you've never heard it like 9 bajillion gazillion times.
I've never heard it at all.
Welcome to Never Listening to the Radio. Yeah. I gave up around like 1998 when I realized that, like, you know, they only play 4 songs over and over.
My husband's doing, there's actually a Harry Potter like takeoff called Dark Lord Funk that he's played for me like 85 times in the last 2 days.
Also, I just thought I'd briefly mention that former Swedish crime reporter David Lagercrantz is writing a fourth Elizabeth Solander novel called The Girl in the Spider's Web, which is both endorsed by the estate of Stieg Larsson and the publisher. So
it's not like some unfinished manuscript? Like
no, it's not the unfinished one. Supposedly there's an entire unfinished manuscript that's being held up by either his estate or his partner. I'm not really sure. But like, I think it's basically done, but this isn't it.
Oh, I thought maybe he was going to be like Tupac or Roberto Bolaño and like, releasing stuff 20 years after they're dead.
Nah.
Tickling my fancy is I am almost done. I've been reading this book for like a month and a half, maybe closing in on 2 months, maybe. This book by Sandra Newman called The Country of Ice Cream Star. It was released earlier this year and it's kind of been a hard nut to crack for me. On the plot level, it's a sort of sounds like a pretty straight-ahead book. It's a dystopian story about a 15-year-old young lady named Ice Cream Star. She lives in a world 80 years after a plague has killed all adults and all white people. Everyone she knows, including herself, will die around the age of 20 by a disease which they call posies. But she soon learns that there's a possible cure, which comes from these people called Ruse, who they were near mythical beast people who are huge and they can live up to 30, and they're white. And you find out later on who they are, what they're doing. These plot details, though, don't really have much to do with the experience of reading the book. Do you know that thing, maybe you'll see it on Facebook or something, where someone will post a block of text and like some of the letters are rearranged and it says, like, if you could read this, you're one of the...
Right.
Now, apparently that there's a made up word for what that is called. It's called typoglycemia, which
sounds
is
like a sugar deficiency.
It sounds sillier than it is, but this book is kind of like that. It's written in a dialect that Sandra Newman created. It uses kind of bits of hip hop slang and like internet slang and English, and then like some kind of like the way like kids mishear words and then like change them into something else. It's gotten comparisons to, apparently there's a section in Cloud Atlas that's written in some weird thing. And then,
okay. Yes.
And then it made me think of Clockwork Orange, how that's written in the, so except there's no glossary, at least the copy of Clockwork Orange that I had glossary in the back. But so it's not impenetrable, it just has taken me a long time. It's been tough for me to read it. And I read for like an hour or more last night. And it really works really well in large doses, because then you can kind of get into the rhythm of reading it. And so like you're not puzzling over what some word means or the way that she's using it means. You kind of just, you're getting it. I guess it's like the deeper you go into it, the better, the easier it is to get the context for something. So I've really enjoyed it. It's a pretty long novel, but it's very good. And that's The Country of Ice Cream Star by Sandra Newman.
Torchwood Series. I have a correction for the corrections. I need to say corrections before I start the corrections, okay?
Yeah, you need that weird R rolling R too.
Corrections! Torchwood Series 3 is called Torchwood Children of Earth, and I said Children of Men. I only nitpick because I love Torchwood Series 3 Children of Earth so much. Of course, Children of Men is a sci-fi novel by P.D. James and a movie starring Clive Owen.
I thought it was the movie.
Yeah, the movie is amazing.
I was made
fantastic.
Perhaps one of the rare examples of a movie being better than a book. I don't know. Debate amongst yourself.
I thought Election, the film, was better than the book. Myself.
I didn't know it was based on the book.
Yeah. Tom Perretta.
Oh. Hate that guy. All right.
I thought Star Wars, the novel, was better than the book.
Which one? 9,432?
The Godfather is way better than the novel.
I've never read the novel.
You ever read Splinter of the Mind's Eye?
What's Alan Dean Foster?
Star Wars book.
But that was never made to a movie. It was between Star Wars and Empire.
It was the first...
I tried to troll you, and you guys started geeking out.
All right. Us geek out?
You try to troll me, yeah, I'm going to roll you.
You fail. We're like sunlight on you trolls.
Go back to your bridge, son.
This podcast kind of works like a message board on 4chan. Sometimes the trolling works, and then sometimes the nerds take over. It just depends which way it goes. And then sometimes it like gets real dirty, and then I have to censor it. Oh, okay. All right. For more information and all these Star Wars books, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Next week,
baseball.
America's pastime.
Cracker Jacks, don't ever come back.